convening the Senate Special Committee on the Oregon Health Plan. We will continue where we left off yesterday. This is Thursday, June 5th, 2003, and it's public hearing on House Bill 3624, which modifies medical assistance program. Yesterday, when we discontinued the meeting, there were individuals who had signed up, and I will begin with those, Jim Russell, Paul Cosgrove, and Mark Nelson, if you were all here. I see Paul. Jim. Why not the two of you come, and then when Mark shows up, he can be in the next panel. Thank you.
I'll be on your way this weekend.
Why?
Yeah, I'll be on during the graduation speaker.
You may begin.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jim Russell. I'm the director for the Mid-Valley Behavioral Care Network. That's one of the mental health organizations in the state. Our region is this county here, Marion, Lynn, Polk, Tillamook, Yamhill. You're receiving a memo addressed to this committee from the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs and the mental health organizations, and they've asked me to speak to you today on this matter. Actually, this is yesterday's memo, and of course, as you know, things change in a day.
You mean sometimes it's in within a minute,
yeah,
or
exactly.
All right, then things always change in a day. So in this memo, I have offered some changes to Section 10 and Section 11 for 3624. But members of the committee last night asked the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs to start working with Legislative Council. And I believe she's taking the intent and shaping a different amendment. I would like to speak to the intent of what I've proposed here. Currently, 3624 provides for the capitation of all the psychiatric medications except for the antipsychotic drugs. And this was done, I think, from the understanding that as many as 70% of the antidepressants are prescribed in primary care. I'm not sure it was done with the awareness of the amount of hospitalization that is related to other medications. My network hospitalized about 500 people last year, and only 40% of those, a little shy of 200 of those people, would have used antipsychotic medications as part of their treatment. The other 60% used other psychiatric medications that would now be, under the current version of the bill, would be capitated to the fully capitated health plans. So,
Senator Carter.
Can you just go back and explain that, the first part of your statement in terms of relationships to hospitalization, and my brain is not moving fast today.
Yes.
And I welcome you here because I've heard such good things about you, so I appreciate you being here.
Oh, well, that's very kind. Thank you. The point I'm making is that the bill proposes to capitate all of the psychiatric medications to the fully capitated health plans, except for the antipsychotics. The health plans have told me that what they would do is establish a formulary and a prior authorization process for those medications. So they would be managing the medications, but the mental health organizations continue to have the financial risk of the hospital care, paying for the hospital care of people who, for example, were on antidepressants but not at an effective level. So in my memo, if you look at the second page, I've highlighted two sections, a couple of lines in the first paragraph and a couple of lines in the second paragraph. The point I'm making right now is in relation to the highlights in the first paragraph. In relation, note please in the second paragraph that I point out that the state has just finished, is beginning to review the results of three pilot projects that they funded that are collaborations between fully capitated health plans and mental health organizations. These pilots used voluntary mechanisms. I'm sorry, I see people looking for where
we're
I might
be. We're looking for where you are because I don't believe we have that.
That's
the Association of Oregon Counties Mental Health Program.
And then looking at the second page, mm-hmm. in the second paragraph.
Okay.
I'm providing a little more
ground information.
Yes. Okay. Thank you, Senator. A little more information about beyond what I highlighted there in the second paragraph. These three pilots were collaborations of mental health organizations and the fully capitated health plans around the management of the psychiatric medications. And they found that there are voluntary strategies that lead with the quality improvement and also result in significant cost savings. You have probably heard testimony already that last year spent approximately $12 million a month on these medications. So the opportunity is great there, and it's definitely worth introducing some management strategies. I believe that it's too much of a mismatch to capitate all of those drugs to the fully capitated health plans when the mental health organizations are responsible for the hospital care. And I think it foregoes to take that approach. It foregoes the learning that the department has already made from those pilots. I know that Dr. David Pollack, the medical director of the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services, provided testimony to the audit committee about these initiatives and other explorations on the part of the department for managing the cost and improving the quality of the administration with psychiatric medications. And perhaps this committee would like to hear from him.
One question, Senator Carter. Mr. Abel, can you tell me who then, since you would have all the risk piece associated with this, who manages, what entity is responsible for the management of the different drugs that a patient has? That troubles me.
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, the psychiatric drugs are currently carved out of the Oregon Health Plan and are paid fee-for-service by the state, and no one is managing them right now.
And so we don't have that piece carved out in this new bill, in 3624?
No. What it does is leaves the antipsychotic medications in fee-for-service, but proposes to capitate or otherwise have the management done by the fully capitated health plans of the rest of the psychiatric medications.
Let's see if I can follow that. In the Senate Bill 819, mm-hmm. we used the terminology or the definition of mental health drugs.
Okay.
In 3624, it specifies not mental health drugs, but it narrowed the, is that correct? Is that where the concern is?
Yes. It says that all the medications except for the antipsychotics, which are only part of the psychiatric medications, or what, as you say in Senate Bill 819, were described as the mental health drugs.
And so without having the other 60%, if you will, mm-hmm. It poses a financial risk. Is that what I hear you saying?
Yes, it does. The medications would be managed by the fully capitated health plans, but the hospital care would still be provided by the mental health organizations. And
Senator Carter?
So in order for you guys to not only be charged with responsibility, but have the opportunity to be fully responsible, we need to carve this piece out for you, and then you have the responsibility and accountability for that.
Yes, I think what I would recommend is that from Section 10 and 11, we exclude all of the psychiatric, or if you want to continue to call it mental health drugs, exclude all of them from 10 and 11. And I understand that legislative counsel believes that someplace else in the bill would be the appropriate place to describe how we could go further with the implementation of the shared responsibility between the mental health organizations and the fully capitated health plans.
Okay.
So I would hope to return to you when we do have that, either myself or someone on the same theme, return to you when we do have that exact amendment.
Continue.
Well, that really is the conclusion. I would like you to entertain this possibility and favorably consider that amendment when it's produced by Legislative Council.
Thank you, Mr. Russell.
Thank you.
Mr. Cosgrove.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Paul Cosgrove, representing the Long-Term Care Pharmacy Association, and along with Mark Nelson, we represent together the long-term care pharmacies, more commonly called institutional pharmacies. And as you know, those are the pharmacies that provide prescription drugs to nursing homes, assisted living facilities, and other community residential facilities like adult foster homes all across the state. We are not retail pharmacies. We do not do a retail pharmacy business. We just supply those institutions. I'm here in support of the A11 amendments. There's a handout, and I'm going to talk about that in just a second. It's the multicolored brochure, but if I can first talk about the concern that raises our concern about the bill and how the A11 amendments address it. You heard a little bit about this yesterday in the panel of the fully capitated health plan, where specifically Ruby Houghton mentioned the A11 amendments and said that she supported them. And that's because in Section 10 of the bill, and the first few lines of this A11 amendment deal with Section 10, it provides that the department would ask fully capitated health plans in the community to manage the drugs for people on fee-for-service system. The thing I think that wasn't fully recognized, at least at the beginning of the process of 3624 coming through the building, is that technically our drugs to institutional clients in these facilities are technically fee-for-service. They're not capitated, so that we were, in fact, put into that process. And I think, as you heard Ms. Houghton say, they agree that that's not appropriate, and I'll explain in a minute just why we agree with that. The second thing that the bill does is it would impose a pharmacy benefit manager not only on the drugs that the ambulatory populations are receiving on fee-for-service cards in the community, but also on the services and pharmacy services we provide to these facilities. If I can then turn to the handout and explain why this kind of administrative oversight that is proposed in Section 10 and pharmacy benefit management services that's proposed in Section 13 doesn't make sense in this context. The page that says a dozen key differences is the one I'll be talking from, and it discusses the differences in how long-term care or institutional pharmacies operate compared to a retail pharmacy. Retail pharmacies do a very good job in their aspect of the business. We're just seeing a much different and serving a much different clientele. And I'd like to highlight in particular some of the things about halfway down that page. We are required by law in our contracts with these facilities to have multiple daily deliveries, stat urgent delivery, 24-hour, 7-day coverage, but also the consulting pharmacy services that we provide really are provided to the facility. Effectively, we are the facility's pharmacist. And the next bullet, the drug utilization review, we actually, our consulting pharmacists go into these facilities to nursing homes once a month, every nursing home that we serve, to assisted living once a quarter, and we do chart reviews. So what we're doing in that sense is we are managing the pharmacy benefits in conjunction with those facilities. Thus, in this context, a pharmacy benefit manager or the fully capitated health care plans would simply just be another layer. No other state, to the best of our knowledge, has ever tried to impose a pharmacy benefit manager on this aspect of institutional pharmacies, and that's in recognition that we are already managing both for the quality issues that you're concerned about and for cost. We all have formularies. We work with those facilities to make sure that drug utilization is both the effective and safe medications as well as the most cost-effective. I would be happy to answer any questions. I think earlier in my testimony I may have said by mistake Section 12. I meant Sections 10, and I think it's Section 13 is the pharmacy benefit manager. Section 12 is the hospitalization one that you've heard so much about. We're not involved in that issue. I may have misspoken, so I apologize for that. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
So basically what you're saying is it's a duplication of effort that's already there, and there. And so there's no need for us to to put another layer on top of management that already exists. Is that?
Madam Chair, that's exactly correct. We're doing the functions that I think are intended to be accomplished in those two sections that aren't normally accomplished in the regular sort of ambulatory system, but are already being accomplished in the institutional setting.
Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Paul Nielsen and Jane Myers.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jane Myers representing the Oregon Dental Association. We just have some flags that came up on House Bill 3624A. I guess the major concern is that there's, in our view, a need to keep the fee-for-service system available. I understand the bill's direction is to move more and more people into managed care. But the way the system works currently is that people aren't assigned to a managed care group. They sign up. So if they don't sign up for a dental care organization, for instance, and even the way it works now, the way I understand it, is at least the first 30 days they are not in a managed care organization. So if they get a toothache, a dental emergency, they're on their own looking for a dentist to treat them. And the fee-for-service schedule is available. The emergency fees are, while they're very low and not really adequate, they do allow dental offices to help people with dental emergencies get some treatment. The other problem that could come up is if dental care organizations went out of business, then you would need a fee-for-service system to be available to back up the areas where a dental care organization is not available. The second thing that we flagged, and this is about the Dash 10 amendment, which dealt with the adequacy of networks, it modifies the definition of fully capitated health plan in this bill. And the fully capitated health plans are included in the definition of prepaid managed care health services organizations. So there's two definitions, and fully capitated is part of prepaid managed care health service organizations. But on the other hand, not all the entities that are prepaid managed care health organizations are fully capitated health plans. So then the question comes up, if you are considering the Dash 10 amendments for adequate network of providers to ensure that services described in ORS 414705 are reasonably accessible, if this is adopted, is it just limited to the fully capitated health plans, or do you want to include the other managed care entities? And the third thing is the payment rates develop from the encounter data, which is in section 9 on page 5. Since the measure moves away from reimbursing costs to just reimbursing providers, the reimbursement, of course, I think everyone understands, is linked to participation. If the cost of providing the service, and I'm talking about costs, not making a lot of profit, is not covered, participation falls off. And that's true for, I think, physicians as well as dentists and any other providers in the system. We don't know what's in the encounter data, and if this is going to be used to set rates, it's important that it reflects the cost of delivering the service, and we can probably figure that out, but we want it to flag it as a possible problem. Be happy to answer any questions if I can.
Questions? I don't think so, Jane. I think they understood it.
Good. Glad.
Well, we're just dazed.
Oh, they're just dazed.
We'll figure it out.
Mr. Nielsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Nielsen. I'm representing my new client today, which is Well Partner Incorporated. For those of you who have had me in your office or in front of committees before, I no longer represent Pharmacia Corporation, and that's because Pharmacia Corporation doesn't exist anymore. So my new client is Well Partner. I'll be very clear about that. Well Partner is a mail order pharmacy owned and operated by Oregonians and ships products out of the Portland area. Just so to be clear about what a mail order pharmacy is, it's a pharmacy service that allows members to order prescriptions by telephone, fax, mail, and the internet and receive their prescriptions through the U.S. mail or other delivery system. Members may receive up to 100-day supply when their physicians write a prescription for mail order. I'm assuming that the members have the Dash 9 amendments before them. This amendment is short and simple. In fact, I'll read it to you just in case you don't. It says, in Section 12A of House Bill 3624, a fully capitated health plan or physician care organization that offers enrollees the option of obtaining prescription drugs through a mail-order pharmacy must use the same mail-order pharmacy used by the Department of Human Services for the department's mail-order pharmacy program. Due to my own naivete, I had meant to have the whatever the provider is that fulfills the description of Section 6 exempted from this amendment, because that the most likely provider that fulfills the description in Section 6 has an extensive mail order service of their own, and we didn't want to conflict with that. The reason for this amendment, which seems perhaps on first reading a bit audacious on the part of a private industry proposing the bill, is number one, the mail order concept itself was left out of House Bill 3624, and not by any omission on the part of the people on the committees of the legislature. It just got missed. The problem is this. Well Partner Incorporated is the winner of a contract for the fee-for-service population in the OMAP department. And when they bid on the fee-for-service contract, they bid very aggressively against national caliber corporations. And they won the bid not because they're an Oregon-based company, but because they had the best bid. And just to give you a flavor for the statistics on that bid, those of you who are familiar with pharmacy business, I think these numbers will mean something to you. The winning bid on generics for Well Partner was average wholesale price minus 60%. For the brand name drugs, it was average wholesale price minus 21%. Those are 6 or 7% below, even for brand names, the rates that most people would normally pay. So the state, I'm trying to make the point, is getting an extremely good deal on this bid. Now,
let me hasten to point out that there are reasons why a mail-order pharmacy can bid like that. They don't have the intense, labor-intensive consulting issues that are sometimes necessary for the institutional pharmacists that were presented earlier, nor do they have the burden of some of the retail issues that come up with your normal store pharmacies. So I hasten to point out that mail-order is only good for certain patients and for certain programs, and it will be a self-limited thing. But it can work for a significant enough population to make it worth it to the state to use it. Now, the bid is based on a book of business that uses certain parameters like what percent is generic, what percent is brand, and what percent are certain types of patients. The problem that House Bill 3624 presents is that because it intends a migration into the managed care operations, it radically changes that book of business. Number one, it reduces the volume, which is in and of itself is not necessarily the largest problem. The biggest problem is that because of the exemptions in the bill for the antipsychotics that were mentioned earlier, those will remain in the fee-for-service population, and a well partner basically will be stuck servicing that portion of the prescriptions, which it would normally be able to counterbalance with the rest of the product mix. And so a big scare went into Well Partner, especially during the last round of budget cutting operations, whereby prescription drug coverage was cut, and they noticed that they had lots and lots of people that came and wanted their prescriptions, and those were those very prescriptions that Well Partner cannot get discounts on. And so they had bid with certain assumptions, and yet the assumptions are changed. I would point out that the amendment does not require mail order to be used by anyone. So it's not what we refer to as a mandate in that sense. But it does serve to reinstate the original intended book of business that Well Partner bid for. It's estimated by the people who have looked at this, and the state itself is trying to encourage the use of mail order, that for every 1% increase in the Oregon Health Plan population that can use mail order, there will be a $1.2 million savings per year to the state. So if the state or the group of people using mail order can up that percentage, there's a lot of savings here that could be gotten. For example, if you got up to 5%, that would save the state $6 million. And those of you who were here in the 2001 session know that this building was stood on its head for a like amount of money on prescription drugs. And this would be a very simple way to get there as well. Now, the first issue and my first order of business has been to talk to the plans, because obviously this ties their hands. And if I were the plans, I would be looking at this with some skepticism, and I don't blame them for that. And contrary to the testimony yesterday, let me just point out that it isn't true that all the fully capitated health plans have made up their mind on this. Some of the plans are going through their policy shops and trying to get an opinion that I'm sure will be forthcoming. The last thing I would say, I guess, is that the amendments, again, don't reflect the idea that we were trying to not include the provider in Section 6. And we have also, just to make this perhaps more of a transitional type of policy, would go along with the sunset of the amendment in 2008 to go along with the sunset of the contract that Well Partner has with the state of Oregon. And to conclude, I would just say that the theme that seems to permeate the building these days on the Oregon Health Plan is that we want to bake the pie with the apples that we got. And we have a very good apple here with Well Partner. This is a thriving, aspiring Oregon company that would like to fill out its contract. the use of mail order encouraged by these amendments. It can cut costs, create efficiencies, and it can provide service. And I would be happy to answer questions.
Questions? Senator Menas.
We need an amendment to the amendment, or a new amendment, that represents, I think, what Paul is suggesting, that Section 6 should be exempt, correct?
So right.
Are we going to have that?
They're working on the amendments. There's so many requests for amendments that we're not going to review amendments today. And I don't believe that we're going to begin looking at amendments until Monday.
I've got legislative council kind of bogged down with some amendments, too. So.
Is that why it's taking me a while to get my amendments out?
I'm just trying to help. Yeah, that's why I can't get them out.
Okay. Any questions of either of Myers or Nielsen? Thank you very much. I'm gonna start.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Never mind. I wanted to ask a question real quickly.
Which one do you want to ask a question of?
Paul.
Mr. Nielsen.
Sorry, Paul, sorry to drag you back here. Is there anything in ORS or administrative rule or in this bill that prevents you from have well partners contract directly within the fully capitated health plans? Is there any prevention from going to the plan itself and saying we will offer you the service?
So your question is, can the plan independently go to the plans and offer the service?
Yeah, can you go independently?
Absolutely.
Okay.
We could do that. And in fact, the well partner already has the business from some of the leading plans, and that's one of the reasons why this is such a propitious time to insert this policy, because there would be a minimal amount of disruption in terms of those relationships. The other thing that your question allows me to comment on then is there are other things that can be accomplished through the mail order operation. For example, disease management is now being dovetailed with Well Partners operation and working directly even with nurses in behalf of the Oregon Health Plan. And so if there's one hub nexus of activity that the state can work with, then it doesn't need to be replicated and reinvented with each additional variation or contract with the individual plans.
Well, are you?
Just a quick follow-up. I would ask we talk to plans about how they feel about this, too, to make sure that we're not tying their hands inadvertently.
Well, thank you again for the questioner, Chair Winters, Representative Bates. And we recognize this does tie their hands to a certain extent. It doesn't tie their hands in that it forces them to use mail order, but at least for a time, if the committee sees fit to put a sunset on this in 2008, it would tie their hands. But we would hope that most of the plans don't use mail order at all. And so this would help encourage that kind of use, and again, sort of school people on the way to get these savings.
And they have done an excellent job. You really have. Well Partners has done an excellent job.
Senator Menas.
Well, I want to ask the committee, or maybe Paul, to ask the question as to whether there may be a constitutional contract clause, impairment contract question here at the legislature. Can nullify a contract that's pre-existing based on the sets of assumptions that underlaid that. Because I don't think, having sat on the PERS committee, and listened to contract law and issues, just kind of sitting out there, and I don't know whether or not that's something that the legislature wants to engage in, if we can avoid it.
May I comment, Senator?
Yes.
Chair Winters, Senator Menas, thank you for that question. And that, again, is one of the reasons for trying to exempt the provider in Section 6. And also, I did ask that question of legislative counsel to be alert to that issue as they go through that. Now, and she said that, Holly said that it wasn't, that she would pay attention, but she couldn't guarantee that there wasn't an issue, and so would certainly research that to meet your concern.
Thank you. Thank you. We talked about amendments, and I would just encourage the public or any that to turn your amendments for drafting by mid-morning tomorrow? Because staff, we have just really been inundated with a lot of amendments, and then we have a prolific writer over here, which has more, and get them to Marjorie Taylor or Mike Bonetto by noonish tomorrow. It would be greatly appreciated so that they can begin matrixing all of these and begin to put everything together in preparation for next week. So I would appreciate your cooperation. Thank you. Tom Holt.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tom Holt. I'm Executive Director of the Oregon State Pharmacists Association. I'm here today to speak to the A16 amendments, which are being distributed. But before I get to that, I would like to associate with Paul Nielsen's amendment from Well Partner. The pharmacists at Well Partner are very active in our organization, and it is a high-quality operation, and I would underscore the point he made that what the bill does by changing the mix of the patients that Well Partner would now have within its contracts, it does substantially change what they agreed to some time ago when they contracted with the state. So we would be supportive of the amendment to the amendment of the A9s.
And they're an Oregon company, too,
aren't they? They are an Oregon-based company, yes. They're in Tualatin. If you have the amendments in front of you, you have two handouts. There's the amendments themselves, and there's a memo that explains the amendments. The memo was done a little bit before the amendments came back from LC, so they're in a little bit different order. So I think what I'll do here is try to go through the amendments themselves. They do a few mainly technical things. First, on the first page of the amendment, then line 3, we suggest adding, as we previously testified in the other Oregon Health Plan Committee, that we exempt persons residing in long-term care facilities, foster homes, etc. It's a little different angle from getting at the same issue that Paul Cosgrove talked about. These people receive specialized services, and putting them in a managed care mandate would really be a duplication of effort in many respects. In addition to the institutional pharmacy services to these individuals, retail pharmacies also do some services in this area. It is quite common, particularly for the independent pharmacies in rural areas, to service these types of facilities, and quite often they have contracts to be the backup pharmacy to the long-term care pharmacies that are largely based in the valley. So if a call comes at 2 o'clock in the morning for an immediate delivery of medication, it's the local pharmacy that gets the call to actually fulfill that at times. So that's a technical suggestion we have there. And then the next item on line 6 and 7 of beginning line 6 of the first page of the amendment is simply an any willing provider provision, so that any provider that wishes to participate in the Oregon Health Plan under the terms and conditions of the fully capitated health plans could do so. And according to Legislative Council, the language here is absolutely identical to that was upheld just a few weeks ago by the U.S. Supreme Court in an any willing provider case involving Medicaid in, I think, the state was Kentucky. So we know this language would be good for that purpose. And then we have a clarification to the much-discussed entity in Section 6, just to clarify that if when the state contracts with that entity that they would not be the only provider of services in its service area. When the councils for our folks looked at this language, while we all understood that the intent was not to make this entity an exclusive provider, there was a concern that the language did not clearly say that that was not the case, and so our suggestion is to add some language that does that. And then we go to, starting out around lines 21, some issues dealing with payments to providers and in particular to pharmacies. We're suggesting here that a requirement be put in the bill that the plans make electronic funds transfer available and that payments to pharmacies be done on an every 10-day basis. In the fee-for-service program currently, the department pays approximately weekly. Pharmacies have to pay their wholesalers approximately every 10 days to 2 weeks, depending on their wholesaler. Their terms and conditions of their wholesale pricing depend upon their ability then to be able to promptly pay their wholesaler. We have had some problems in recent months of intermediaries, the subcontractors to the health plans who handle payments, actually sitting on checks for weeks at a time. And it seems bizarre to us that we take an entirely electronic claim system in the pharmacy arena and turn it into paper checks that people can sit on and then live off money off the float from those checks that actually belong to the providers who have provided the service. To give you some idea of the scale of problem that causes, pharmacies' net margins these days are in the 1 to 2% range. If they are not on time paying their wholesaler for their deliveries, they lose 1 to 2 percentage points of pricing on from their wholesaler. So it's a very important issue. And then moving on to page 2 of the amendment, there's really this is a technical thing, but you'll notice that in the section that discusses on page 7 of the bill, which is section 13, the pharmacy benefit manager, we change the word manager to administrator. That's a very subtle but important change. First Health, which is the fee-for-service administrator for the Oregon Health Plan drug program now, functions as an administrator in that they process the claims, they adjudicate data, they assist the department in getting rebates from the pharmaceutical manufacturers. A pharmacy benefit manager, on the other hand, more commonly engages in a number of other services, including providing pharmacy services. They often are engaged actually in handling funds. We think it's more appropriate that what middlemen we have here be engaged to handle data and to be administrators for the department, so the department is sure that that it is getting absolutely the best deal it possibly can. And then,
Madam Chair,
Representative Weston.
Sorry to be sitting in President Courtney's chair, but I will allow that he has never looked as good. Tom, aren't we really talking about a distinction without a difference here? I mean, you can have, in the bill, it can be a pharmacy benefits manager, but the contract or the employment, the required responsibilities of that PBM can just be the administrative function you so correctly articulate. What is the harm in leaving the language as a pharmacy benefits manager, which is permissive and would allow other functions should the state so desire? Or it could be just left alone as it currently is and they still perform the functions that you are trying to limit it to of a PBA.
Chair Winters, Representative Westland, thank you for the question. The first thing I should emphasize is that the term pharmacy benefit administrator does tie into a definition that's elsewhere in statute according to LC, and so by using that term, we in effect say that it's the PBA would do those things that I described. in answer to your question of, you know, what's the harm, we see some potential problems in having a pharmacy benefits manager in the middle of this, in that there has been quite a bit of question nationally about PBMs and methodologies they use and whether or not they actually give the people who are paying, who are contracting with them, a fair deal in terms of passing back rebates to them and so on. A PBA could still negotiate on behalf of the state to get the rebates from manufacturers and carry out all those very important claims processing functions, but you would sort of protect the state against the conflicts of interest that PBMs, we think, inherently have.
Senator Carter.
Tom, is there a group out there today that is accountable to the state in terms of rebates? Where some do it and some don't. That's my
Chair Winters, Senator Carter, in the fee-for-service program, what occurs now is First Health account, as part of their contract, they do an accounting of the rebates that the state is entitled to. My understanding is they assist the state, and the state directly contracts the rebates with the manufacturers. First Health might be a better one to ask the questions of how that technically works, but that's my understanding of how that takes place currently in the fee-for-service program.
Thank you.
And if I may continue, the last thing is we're suggesting, and to some degree we don't have a dog in this hunt, but we think it would be good public policy. We're suggesting a new Section 20 that would require certain financial disclosures related to Oregon Health Plan business by the FCHPs on a regular basis, so that there is accountability for what is, you know, very substantial state funds, and to provide an ability of the state and providers to have, you know, a means to assess whether there's any early warning flags going up in terms of the financial condition of capitated health plans. And we also have in that section a suggestion of an aggregate accounting of rebates that those organizations receive. We would not think it would be a good idea to require an itemized accounting, because that would get into exposing what should be confidential negotiations that they have with the manufacturers. But we do think it's important, as the state moves forward, to be able to assess whether, on a net basis, you know, this is really the best way to go in terms of figuring out, in the fee-for-service area, you have direct rebates to the state, and how that plays out through the managed care organizations, whether, you know, which is the better deal for the state. And we think some kind of disclosure on a regular basis would be a good way to do that. And with that, I'd be happy to take any additional questions you might have.
And you are submitting that information before noon tomorrow to staff?
Yes.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you, Mr. Holt. Dolores Hubert and Jacqueline Zimmer.
Chair Winters and members of the committee, my name is Dolores Hubert, and I chair the Health and Long-Term Care Committee for the Governor's Commission on Senior Services, and I'm here today to express our concerns with the current version of the AN Gross 36, House Bill 3624. We have three primary concerns. First is the total reliance on managed care plans. second is the requirement for an additional services organization to manage critical auxiliary services. And lastly is the lack of exceptions to mandatory enrollment in fully capitated health plans. Perhaps I can explain. The Commission is aware of the budget problems we are facing, and we know that something has to be done to control the costs within the Oregon Health Plan. However, depending on the fully capitated health plans, when we have seen so many that have fled, seems rather unrealistic. We have not heard of any plans to entice the fully capitated health plans back to serving the Oregon Health Plan populations, and the remaining fully capitated health plans do not have the capacity to handle the entire population. Creating an administrative service organization to manage durable medical equipment, hospital services, prescriptions, medical transportation will be very problematic for seniors and people with disabilities. In a traditional managed care organization, decisions that result in bad outcomes for clients mean that managed care organizations still are responsible for their treatment, even if that treatment means additional funds have to be expended. This creates incentives for fully capitated health plans to proactively provide necessary services and supplies. The administrative service organizations will have no such incentives. They can manage very aggressively. They can limit access to critical services like custom wheelchairs, and they will not be responsible for deterioration and health complications. A perfect example is someone who is a wheelchair bound and who needs a custom wheelchair to prevent decubitus ulcers. The administrative service organizations will see no benefit in the custom wheelchair, but the cost to treat the ulcers will land in the lap of OMAP. Additionally, if these administrative service organizations deny needed equipment and services, seniors and people with disabilities may be forced to cover these supplies through their special needs if long-term care clients are to remain in their own home or in community-based services. We recommend that you delete Section 10 from the bill and ask the Department of Human Services to establish in specific rule, specific criteria to control costs for these categories, and to allow the Department of Human Services to create a centralized prior authorization system. Lastly, we are concerned that there is no exception for mandatory enrollment in the fully capitated health plans for people with extensive medical issues. There should be an exception for continuity of care. People with chronic and or complex medical conditions need to be able to stay with their primary care physicians and their specialists. Sometimes this means that they will not be able to participate in a fully capitated health plan. The Department of Human Services needs the ability to allow this to happen. We ask that this committee firmly state on the record that DHS will be able to create in rule needed exception criteria. Thank you for allowing me to testify before you today.
Are there any questions? Representative Bates.
Madam Chair, I'd like to point out that in Section 10, and in awarding any contract, the department has to be certain it's cost neutral or cost saving, number one. If there's capacity to do the job, and the department has the right under Section 10 to exempt individuals they feel should be exempted, plus we have an exception process. We did discuss these issues when we drafted the bill, and they were concerning to us. There might be individuals who would not be properly taken care of. Trying to go for cost savings here, but still giving the department, OMAP, the right to exempt people out and the right to say this has got to be a savings for the department if we're even going to go in that direction. We put those two sections in there for a very specific purpose to answer the very question you've risen here, too. And I think it's covered in the bill, if I'm reading it properly.
We just wanted to make sure that we could express our concern, Representative Bates.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wesley.
Bill, first of all, thank you for the very lovely card.
And you're welcome.
But secondly, I think your concern is very expressly addressed in the bill. I mean, there's a very specific list of categories of exceptions, and then we also have a specific line at the end of all those specific exceptions giving the department a great deal of latitude, mm-hmm. particularly with regard to the continuity of care. I mean, you're absolutely correct about keeping people with their current, I think primarily would obviously be fee-for-service and those with clients with a great deal of medical need. I mean, that's in there. So your concern is right on the target, and I think we addressed it.
We just wanted to make sure, Representative Westland, that everything was on the record. So that was my only concern.
Understand.
And, Dolores, we will make certain when we review all of the...
Thank you. I appreciate that. Yes. Senator Winters.
Your and Phyllis's card.
That's all right.
Jacqueline Zimmer.
Oh, good afternoon, Madam Chair, co-chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jacqueline Zimmer Jones, the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging.
You didn't put the last name on it.
I know. I'm just not used to that. It's just too much. I sort of feel like, I don't know if you feel this way, but sometimes I write a paper for my bosses, and I have 18 of them, and it comes back with red marks all over it, and I hope you don't feel that way. We really do appreciate the work that you've put into this particular issue, and... You know, I'm just going to start following these guys doing testimony because then I really don't have to say too much except like, well, what she said is pretty much what we think. So, the couple things that we want to point out, and if Representative Westland and Representative Bates say that the issues that we're concerned about, which are the exceptions for people who really should not shift, are covered in this language, and most likely if you take me out and hit me over the head with this a couple times, it might sink in. I will edit my testimony to exclude that. And also the issue of the ASOs being responsible for things like durable medical equipment and exemptions. I'd like to think that is in fact in here, and maybe I'm just not interpreting it correctly. But a couple of points I will make is, you know, there's really no exception that an ASO is going to get this stuff right either.
Yeah.
And they're not on the ground with our clients like we are. And I'm not sure what their incentive is to tell somebody yes. It's a lot easier and more productive as a company to tell somebody no. And in the end, it's the client that suffers. The person in the managed care organization or the ASO office goes home and feels the same as they did when they went to work. But our client, who doesn't have the product that they need or the supplies that they need, is the one that really does the suffering. And so if you've got that in mind in this bill, we'll settle down on that particular point. One of the issues that we raised a little bit earlier, and I'm just going to raise it for the fun of it today, is that, we have endured managed care companies coming and going in Oregon ever since we really started promoting that plan here. And what happens to us as providers is that when a managed care company folds or is forced to fold or leaves town or says it doesn't have enough money to operate, we're left holding the bag. I mean, we're left to fund the re-enrollment of those clients into a different managed care plan or to find them alternative providers. And we do not get reimbursed for that. That's just part of what we do as a service. So I think if managed care companies are going to step up to the plate a little more on this, it'd be wonderful if they left a little bit of money behind for us to use to help the people that they've left behind. And I don't say that they're being malevolent when they do that. It's just that when you fold, and then the state's left paying for the case management to find these folks alternatives. And I think that's something that we ought to think about because it's happened to us a number of times in the past. So, and then the other piece I want to talk about as far as the ASO issue goes is that, you know, quite honestly, again, we're on the ground. And what would probably save you some money is if there was more training, more regular training for folks that actually navigate for the durable medical equipment, so that it's all maybe all done in a standardized form, in a standardized fashion, just a little more training, and to keep in mind that we have turnovers in our agencies and people have to be trained and brought on board and trained effectively. So think about that. But a company that you might designate this responsibility to has the same issues. They're going to have new staff. They're going to need to be trained. They're going to have turnovers. I mean, I'm not sure that there's really a guarantee that an ASO will save you money except in denials. I mean, they're going to have the same issues that we do. They have to pay people to do their work. So, I mean, we think we're the best qualified to do it simply because this is a human services organization and we're really concerned about human services. So it's a little different than a business organization. So with that, I will answer any questions or... Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jacqueline.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Jacqueline Zimmer Jones. Elizabeth Byers. Have you seen some of the materials? I don't remember. Okay.
Good afternoon, Chair Winters and Co-Chair Courtney and members of the committee. I'm here today to speak briefly to support the Oregon Health Action Campaign's work that they're doing now to come up with an amendment to that will address the issues that Ellen talked about yesterday, specifically working to make sure that plans will cover folks in the areas that they committed to have.
I'm sorry. You need to identify yourself for the record.
I'm sorry. Elizabeth Byers with Oregon Health Action Campaign. Sorry about that. So we also are working on an amendment that will address that there are medically fragile adults in the same way that there are medically fragile children. And we're also working with this amendment to include some of the really good patient protections that Oregon's, that the legislature's passed in the last two sessions. For instance, women over 40 have preventative routine annual mammogram and pap smear that they can self-refer, and also that plans have local advisory boards or local consumer advisory groups that can give input to the plans and the local areas to say what the issues are that they're seeing with consumers. So we appreciate the opportunity to have this a little extra leeway to work on these amendments. And I also just want to make a point about people's access to managed care. And you know, we really believe that managed care does work for a lot of people. It works, of course, most easily for people who are always healthy, and works a lot for people who have conditions that the managed care plan has providers that address. But for some people, like Mike Volpe, who was here yesterday, who he's been ill for some time. He has an established relationship with a provider that's not in managed care, and several conditions that provider is helping him to deal with. And we're hoping that there's going to be room in the bill that will allow for those folks to maintain their relationships with their providers, much like the other people have just testified about. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? We have, thank you. Senator Minnis isn't here, but we're going to pass out his amendment to you so you can have it to review. I thought he was going to be here so he could explain it, but he's not. And we're not going to have any meeting tomorrow nor Saturday. I know you're going to miss us coming here on Saturday, but it'll give staff some time to work on the amendments, and we will adjourn until, I believe it's Monday. So we are adjourned unless there's any more business until Monday.